He patted Guinafra's blonde hair, which was almost 6 inches long. I felt much the same about the helpless and abused little ones, too. "What kind of a world is it that doesn't have children?" Alice said. "For that matter, what kind without animals? If they can't be mistreated or abused any more, they can't be petted and loved."
"One thing balances out another in this world," Burton said. "You can't have love without hate, kindness without malice, peace without war. In any event, we don't have a choice in the matter. The invisible lords of this world have decreed that we do not have animals and that women no longer bear children. So be it." The morning of the 416th day of their journey was like every morning. The sun had risen above the top of the range on their left. The wind from upriver was an estimated 15 miles per hour, as always. The warmth rose steadily with the sun and would reach the estimated 85 degrees Fahrenheit at approximately 2 in the afternoon. The catamaran, the Hadji, tacked back and forth. Burton stood on the bridge with both hands on the long, thick pine tiller on his right, while the wind and the sun beat on his darkly tanned skin. He wore a scarlet and black checked kilt reaching almost to his knees and a necklace made of the convoluted, shiny black vertebrae of the hornfish. This was a 6-foot-long fish with a 6-inch-long horn that projected unicorn-like from its forehead. The hornfish lived about 100 feet below the surface and was brought in on a line with difficulty. But its vertebrae made beautiful necklaces. Its skin, properly tanned, made sandals and armor and shields, or could be worked into tough, pliable ropes and belts. Its flesh was delicious. But the horn was the most valuable item. It tipped spears or arrows or went into a wood handle to make a stiletto. On a stand near him, encased in the transparent bladder of a fish, was a bow. It was made of the curved bones protruding from the sides of the mouth of the whale-sized dragonfish. When the ends of each had been cut so that one fitted into the other, a double recurved bow was the result. Fitted with a string from the gut of the dragonfish, this made a bow that only a very powerful man could fully draw. Burton had run across one 40 days ago and offered its owner 40 cigarettes, 10 cigars, and 30 ounces of whiskey for it. The offer was turned down. So Burton and Kaz came back late that night and stole the bow, or rather made a trade, since Burton felt compelled to leave his U-bow in exchange. Since then, he had rationalized that he had every right to steal the bow. The owner had boasted that he had murdered a man to get the bow, so taking it from him was taking it from a thief and a killer. Nevertheless, Burton suffered from thrusts of conscience when he thought about it, which was not often. Burton took the Hadji back and forth across the narrowing channel. For about 5 miles, the river had widened out to a 3.5-mile broad lake, and now it was forming into a narrow channel less than 0.5 mile across. The channel curved and disappeared between the walls of a canyon. There the boat would creep along because it would be bucking an accelerated current, and the space allowed for tacking was so limited. But he had been through similar straits many times, and so was not apprehensive about this. Still, every time it happened, he couldn't help thinking of the boat as being reborn. It passed from a lake, a womb, through a tight opening and out into another lake. It was a bursting of waters in many ways, and there was also the chance of a fabulous adventure, of a revelation on the other side. The catamaran turned away from a grailstone, only 20 yards off. There were many people on the right side plane, which was only 0.5 mile across here. They shouted at the boat, or waved, or shook their fists, or shouted obscenities, unheard, but understood by Burton because of so many experiences. But they didn't seem hostile. It was just that strangers were always greeted by the locals in a varied manner. The locals here were a short, dark-skinned, dark-haired, thin-bodied people. They spoke a language that Ruach said was probably Proto-Hamite-Semitic. They had lived on Earth somewhere in North Africa or Mesopotamia when those countries had been much more fertile. They wore the towels as kilts, but the women went bare-breasted and used the bras as neck scarves or turbans. They occupied the right bank for 60 grailstones, that is, 60 miles. The people before them had been strung out for 80 grailstones and had been 10th century A.D. Ceylonese with a minority of pre-Columbian Mayans. The mixing bowl of time,
Frigate called the distribution of humanity, the greatest anthropological and social experiment ever.